From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today on the show, trying to navigate the difficult landscape of sex, power, and consent on college campuses.
Later, novelist Tom Perata explores some of that same landscape, both among college students and the parents they leave behind at home.
The question is, how do middle-aged people reinvent themselves? How do they find happiness if they've been feeling trapped? Because it does seem like they're not offered the kind of opportunities to be open and fluid and adventurous that young people are.
And the ambitious aim of the Young Theater Company opening a production of Next to Normal this week at Next Act Theater.
Our goal has really become to create an environment for artists to take on roles that they wouldn't have and to add to what's really becoming a growing, blossoming arts scene here in Milwaukee.
Lake Effect is next, but first, the news.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Students at colleges and universities around Wisconsin and the country are generally back on campus and in class by this point in September. For freshmen, it's often their first real taste of freedom, a time when they're becoming adults and breaking free of limitations they've had growing up at home.
It's a time of experimentation for many, with alcohol, street drugs, and with sex. And for the college and university environments, the sexual landscape in the 21st century is a complex one, with the hookup culture coexisting with greater awareness of sexual assault and the importance of consent.
Writer Vanessa Gregoriadis tries to navigate these shifting waters in a new book called Blurred Lines, Rethinking Sex, Power, and Consent on Campus. We should note that this is obviously a topic that might not be right for younger listeners. Vanessa Gregoriadis, welcome to Lake Effect.
Thanks so much for having me.
So can we address something head on at the start? There was a little hesitation I had in taking on this interview, primarily because I am, you know, a man, and men are generally seen on a particular side of this kind of fraught environment. What did you see as the place of men in this conversation as you started digging into it?
I think it's rapidly changing, actually, the place of men in the conversation about sexual assault, particularly on campus, because there are so many guys, straight guys, guys who like to date girls, who are opening up to the reality that, you know, girls in college have a really different sexual playing field than guys do. And only by having guys as allies are we going to be able to fix the problem. You know, it's like a two-person dance. Gotta do it together.
Well, and you know, this is both a very easy book to read for, you know, your compelling writing style, but a really tough book to read for the picture it paints of the politics of sex on college campuses. It has been a while since you were a college student, and I was a college student, to be honest. What were the biggest surprises you found when you went back both to your alma mater, but more broadly to college campuses in general?
Yes, I went back to college campuses. I was there about 20 years after I graduated. So I figured, you know, as a mother of two, who better to explore sex on campus today other than me? And, you know, I think that the hookup culture, right, which all of us know that phrase, and sociologists think that started in the 90s. So when I was in school in Connecticut, that was beginning to be the way that college students interacted romantically. You know, hookup meaning, you know, kind of no strings. Oh, we'll just see if we both go to this party and we end up chatting, then maybe we'll go home with each other. But I don't really need anything from you and you don't need anything from me, right? And that is now really the norm on college campuses in terms of the beginning of dating. Of course, dating still happens. Of course, people still have long-term boyfriends and girlfriends. But at the beginning, there's very little of like, hey, can I bring you flowers and take you out to a movie tonight? You know, it's more like the Netflix and chill, right? That's, you know, that's a shorthand for what's going on.
Right. It seems like the whole nature of friendships has kind of changed. I mean, even people who aren't necessarily thinking of dating or were even thinking of hooking up, there seems like this sexually charged nature to friendships that a generation ago there might not have been.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's friends with benefits, you know, and part of friendship involves like, well, are we going to ever hook up? I mean, are we going to hook up or not? Like, because, you know, there's the friendship zone and then there's the hooking up zone and which side are you on and how do I categorize this person? But there's also like a lot of blurriness there of like, oh, okay, well now we hooked up, but we can be friends after. You know, I think it's just, it's all really very vague. And that was something that I found really striking because when you look at millennials, they're super planners, right? They want to get into a good school. They want to do well at that school. They're, you know, focused on like maybe not moving out of their mom or dad's house and getting a great job, but focused on their social media pages and how they can make them cool too. You know, and I spent a lot of time at Syracuse in the sororities, and you see these girls who really are, you know, top of the class, perfectly dressed, the sweatshirt with the Greek letters has no stains, like everything is the Google calendar, and I've got 12 extracurriculars. And then, you know, their sex lives are totally vague. And, well, I don't know, I'm going to kind of do whatever the guy wants, and maybe I'll hook up, and maybe I won't, and, you know, maybe I'll go all the way if he wants to. I said I wouldn't, but then I showed up that night, and he wanted to, so I did. So there's a lot of kind of unresolved feelings, I think, around sex, particularly in this generation in college.
Well, and they're organized and they're driven in a lot of ways, but they are still, you know, 18 to 21 year olds.
Right.
I mean, these are not fully formed people yet.
Yeah, they're post adolescents and they, you know, they don't have like a totally, I mean, they're academically, they're able to perform like adults, but emotionally they're still in a different place.
You know, so there are some people, and I gather you are one of them, that say there needs to be a way to add some nuance to the equation, that it doesn't necessarily make sense to put confused hookups in the same category as, you know, serial predators and gang rapes. And are there college campuses, as you got into it, that you saw having any success in addressing the gray areas?
Yeah, I do think a lot of college campuses that have adopted this yes means yes standard, which to a lot of adults sounds ridiculous, right? We all grew up with, if the woman does not say no, then no rape occurred, right? It is the woman's responsibility to say, I don't want to do this, push the guy away. Something, you know, really dramatic has to happen there. Or a no, a shouted no, right? And now colleges want kids to think of it in a slightly different way. They want them to ask, do you want to have sex? That is the way that they want an encounter to proceed, so that the onus is not really on the girls to say no.
Well, and you talked with a number of college-age men or boys who have been accused of sexual assault. How did you view their stories when it came to, you know, these questions of things like affirmative consent, as they call it?
Mm-hmm. I mean, the thing is that the college-age boys who are accused of assault, that, you know, largely are who then take their stories to the media, right, are largely accused of these gray zones encounters. You know, you don't get a lot of physically violent rapists coming to the media and saying, I didn't do it. But those encounters, you know, it becomes really tough, because as much as a lot of feminists would like to say, you can't reduce this to a he said, she said, well, but you actually, like, if you're looking at it like a police detective, it looks a lot like a he said, she said to the police detective, right? There's very little physical evidence. You know, usually not injuries, maybe even a string of text messages before the encounter that involve flirtation, maybe on social media, maybe on Snapchat. And so it's really tough, because you do feel for these boys. At the same time, you don't know for sure if they've done it or haven't. really in a mystery zone there, I think, in a lot of cases.
Right. I mean, I think you quote, you know, Niels Bohr's principle of great truths, you know, that there are situations that exist in which both the accuser and the accused like feel honestly like they're telling the truth here.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that, you know, people who study this problem really think like we are caught in a moment of vast transition, not only in the way women are perceived professionally or socially in terms of women being breadwinners or taking on roles outside the home. You know, on college campuses, more girls are graduating than boys, right? But we're also in this vast transition in terms of the way that sexual dynamics are, you know, happening in the bedroom. And there are boys who are kind of caught in this time of transition. And we need to be fair to them, right? We need to say, well, you know, there are some cases where the boy will say, I truly didn't assault her. And the girl will truly feel assaulted, and they could both actually be right.
What might seem like sexual exploration to some might, you know, seem like sexual assault to others.
There is a fine line. At the same time, you know, there are a lot of guys who are stepping over the line.
Sure.
Like particularly girls who are really drunk to the point of not being able to speak English. You know, if you are flirting with that girl at a party and then taking her home, like I think college students are now pretty much coming into alignment that that doesn't make you cool. Like you just took a girl with beer goggles home. Like, great, that was really easy, huh? You took advantage of her, you know? Whether or not she's going to go to the police and try to get you locked up for it, or go to her campus administrator and try to get you kicked out of school, and where between, you know, being very drunk and aware of what she's doing and being to the point of incapacitation, which is like, you know, blacked out, maybe, certainly passed out, right? I don't know. Those are hard questions to answer. But what we do know is that the social norm around taking that girl home, you know, has really changed in terms of college guys not like high-fiving the guy the next day and saying, wow, that was awesome. You nailed that girl. Like that's not cool anymore. I think that's a big deal. And I think that, you know, kids should be commended for thinking through a lot of these problems on their own. You know, because they're not just listening to what the college deans are telling them, right? You know, they're really thinking about it. So, you know, changes, good changes are happening, you know, and I think we need to give them a little, you know, bit of applause for that.
Do you think colleges can address the issue of sexual politics like this without also getting into the issue of alcohol and casual drug use?
No, I don't. I really don't, because I think a lot of the assaults that are happening, and they're always happening this time of year, September, late August, early September, between, you know, two people who don't know each other very well, who just arrived on campus. It's something like 88% of all gang rape victims on college campuses are freshmen. And like over 3/4 of them are drunk. And either the guys will try to give alcohol to the girl and get the girl drunk because, you know, that's thought of as an easier way to get laid, or he'll really be a predator and really like trying to get the girl drunk. So, you know, really targeting her, which is horrible. Or the girl will be really drunk to the point where she may kind of wander into some guy's room at 4 a.m. who lives 2 floors down from her, who she just thought was cute. And maybe she just wants to go and like giggle and, you know, make some jokes. And, you know, from his point of view, you just came into my room at 4 a.m. Like, I think I know what you want, you know. And so he may push boundaries that she doesn't want to have pushed. So a lot of this weird stuff going on at the beginning of school, and a lot of it is connected to alcohol and drug use among, you know, kids who maybe haven't used that stuff that much at home. Right. And they don't know when to stop drinking. Right. Like they don't know, like 20 rum and cokes, not a good idea. Hold on, you know. So.
Well, and so would you make the point that as colleges are bringing kids in for orientation and they're talking about things like affirmative consent, they ought to also be talking about things like alcohol and drug use?
Yeah, Yeah, I think they are talking about all of that, but they're talking about it separately. I think they have to discuss, like, consent is golden and don't drink your consent away. Don't, you know, after 9 drinks, a woman has a much higher probability of being assaulted. Now, 9 drinks for a woman, for an 18-year-old girl, well, that's a lot of drinks, you know? So I think that is a really important part of talking about, okay, go out, have a couple drinks. You know, this is college. Your mommy and daddy aren't looking over your shoulder, right? You're a big girl now. We all know that. But, you know, don't go somewhere with a bunch of people you don't know and continue to drink through the whole night. When you feel yourself getting out of control, go home, you know? I think that's really important.
Do you feel like you came out of the 3 years of reporting that you did for this book with any more clarity than you had when you went into it?
Well, I think this is an incredibly complicated problem, you know, and it is based on longstanding norms of how women and men should interact, and the college campus being a place where you just meet so many fellow classmates who are really strangers during the course of a night. And you just trust all of them because you think they're your friends, because they're your classmates, even though you don't really know them. You know, there's so many inputs here, from pop culture telling kids that they need to have sex all the time. You know, that makes them cool. So many different kinds of inputs. But what I really felt like optimistic about were the actual kids I met. Like, the kids are all right. Like, they're smart. They're articulate on this subject. They're thinking this issue through. They're like, you know, they're not like these iPhone addicted droids that we think of. And like, while they may like sit at your kitchen table looking at their phones, like, you know, when they did the interviews with me, they didn't look at their phones and they were totally engaged and bringing in all sorts of books that they had read in school and ideas that they had gotten from different films they had seen. And, you know, this generation is going to be fine. They just, you know, need to set clear boundaries, think about, you know, what they want to do each night and not just like leave a lot up to chance and then find themselves in risky situations that they can't get out of.
It's so funny. I was thinking back to my days in college, and I distinctly remember one of my parents taking a picture of me in like 1990 next to a sign that seemed really risque. It advertised campus condom days. And that seems so, that seems so quaint today.
It's actually true. Yeah, you know, you see a lot about consent these days and not a lot about condoms. I mean, it's interesting, but it's kind of one's replaced the other a little bit.
Well, Vanessa Gregoriadis, it's easy to see why this is such a charged issue, but thanks for leading us through it somewhat.
Thank you.
Let's talk about sex, baby. Let's talk about you and me. Let's talk about all the good things and the bad things that may be. Let's talk.
Vanessa Gregoriadis' book is just out. It's called Blurred Lines, Rethinking Sex, Power, and Consent on Campus. We reached her in New York.
The characters in writer Tom Perata's latest book are also trying to make sense of their place in the sexual landscape, the 21st century. One is a college student, the other is his mom, now an empty nester. We'll talk with Tom Perata when Lake Effect continues on WUWN.
Tell it like it is and how it could be, how it was and of course how it should be. Those who think it's dirty have a choice, pick up the needle, press pause, or turn the radio off.
More of Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Before the break, we talked about the real-life challenges surrounding sex, power, and consent on college campuses. While the challenges may be similar in Tom Perata's new book, the characters who are dealing with them are fictional. Mrs. Fletcher tells the story of Eve, a divorced mom who suddenly finds herself an empty nester after dropping her son off at college.
Brandon is her son, and he gets to school with a certain attitude towards women and sex that he finds challenged when he gets there. Meanwhile, Eve is having perhaps the opposite awakening. It's a novel that is both extremely uncomfortable and very funny. And Tom Perata, who's also known for books such as Election and The Leftovers, joins us on the line from Massachusetts, a warning that our conversation includes some frank discussion about sexuality. Welcome to the show.
No, it's my pleasure.
So how much of your own current life or recent life, anyway, did you mine for this latest book?
I always mine my life in the broadest sense. My kids went off to college in recent years, and I was thinking about the sort of dilemma and opportunity of the empty nest. And then I think, I use my imagination to create the characters, but I draw on my own personal obsessions, which in this case had a lot to do with my interest in college and sex and identity and gender and all the turmoil around that area of American life over the past few years.
Do you have especially strong memories of when you went off to college?
I do. And in fact, one of the things I realized when I brought my kids was that I felt like it was that they were in my world. I so associate myself with who I was in college that I felt like, hey, wait a minute, I'm the one who's supposed to be here. I had this kind of very almost like agitated reaction to being back in college because I just thought, oh, this is where I really was alive. I kind of envied my kids for being there and envied them that experience that they were about to have. And I think Eve has some of that, too, like in the very first chapter. Eve is Mrs. Fletcher, the main character. She finds herself at her son's college and feels like everyone was going to a party that she wasn't invited to, and she feels like it's not fair, even though she knows it's a ridiculous feeling.
So I mean, this idea that you sort of feel most yourself or most alive in that era, and Eve kind of has that same feeling. It's interesting because college is clearly similar, but a different place than it was when you were in school, or when Eve was in school, or when I was in school.
Yes, and I think part of the fun of the book is that Eve has this idea about college that I think people of my generation have, which is this is a place where you're going to go and your mind is going to be opened and you're going to meet people who are different from you and you'll be able to kind of invent yourself and transform yourself. Her son, oddly, does not subscribe to that idea of college. He wants to kind of remain the guy he was in high school because he was a very successful frat boy, jock, bro, and it turns out that college is kind of hostile to the guy he wants to be. But Eve herself goes and takes a night school class, and in a way has the exact experience that she wants her son to have. She meets interesting new people. She encounters ideas that challenge her. She does arguably unwise. It has unwise adventures, but that are very instructive and that lead her, I think, in the end, to a fuller sense of who she is and what she wants.
Right. I mean, and to go back to Brendan for a second, I mean, I think a lot of readers, or I suspect a lot of readers, are going to kind of pin Brendan as the embodiment of, I don't know, everything that's wrong with how kids are growing up today, the sense of entitlement that they're kind of that some would say that they are coasting through life with. But do you see, is Brendan entirely unredeemable?
Well, I think that is the question that the book poses. He comes, I think our first encounter with him is highly unflattering. we hear him using a kind of misogynist language that he's probably learned from watching porn. We see him kind of treating his girlfriend with a certain disdain. We see him we understand how limited his mental universe is and how happy he is with those limits. But we see him through the eyes of his mom as well, and she sees what we always see when we look at our kids, a wounded child who she has high hopes for. And I think, throughout the book, we kind of struggle with two visions of Brendan. One is this kind of insufferable and unredeemable bro, and kind of a lost, immature guy who has some glimmers of intelligence and humanity. And I think the book really does ask us to say what really would be a positive change in Brendan's life. It's not like he has some epiphany and changes on a dime, but he does get hurt and ponder his choices and kind of develop a slightly more perceptive sense of who he is and what he wants. So I just answered the question. I don't think he's hopeless.
You know, he and Eve are both going through these awakenings over the course of the book, but his are much more subtle.
Exactly. He's resisting the lessons of the world, whereas Eve, I think because she's unhappy with who she is at the beginning, is embracing change. She has this sense that any kind of change, any kind of action is better than the kind of stasis that she's been dealing with. Whereas Brendan has this feeling of like, I'm fine the way I am. And so any kind of change is a little bit threatening to him.
Which is kind of turning the dynamic on its head in a way, because we think of older people as more set in their ways.
Yeah, this is, I think, why I was so drawn to Eve and to this moment of, the cliche is, you know, the empty nest, when your parenting career is over and you look at your life and say, who am I now? And I guess if you're happy with who you are now, then you can just embrace more of the same. But Eve isn't happy, and I think that's her starting point. And the question is, how do middle-aged people reinvent themselves? How do they find happiness if they've been feeling trapped? Because it does seem like they're not offered the kind of opportunities to be open and fluid and adventurous that young people are. And so it's kind of interesting to watch this middle-aged woman, I think, take these various steps to rethink her life.
Not to put too fine a point on it, but one of the various steps is her sudden interest and affinity for pornography involving people, you know, her peers, if you will.
Yeah, and, you know, I would almost say, like, that wasn't, it's, at the beginning, it wasn't really a choice. You know, she receives an anonymous text that uses a sort of a porn acronym, you know, a mom of a certain age, and she looks it up because she's not quite sure she knows what it means, and she discovers that, well, it's also a kind of a compliment to be thought this way. It means you still are attractive, and that, it, you know, she accepts that. She doesn't like getting an anonymous text, but she likes the implicit compliment, but she also Googles it and comes across these sites where women in their 30s, 40s, and 50s are, sharing their sex lives with the world. And she doesn't approve. She's not somebody who cares about porn or likes porn, but she finds herself drawn to it. And I think that's pretty common in our culture right now. When we're alone, we go to the internet to find solace. And that can be, you know, relatively innocuous things like, I'm going to go through my news feed on Facebook and like the stuff my friends have posted. But in a lot of cases, you know, people go on dating apps, or they go and look at porn, and he finds herself slowly just kind of a little bit obsessed with these sites and thinking of herself as one of these women. She thinks of herself as a MILF. And once she does, a lot of ordinary encounters in her life become eroticized. She starts to sense there's erotic possibility in all kinds of innocent interactions with other people.
And, you know, I think the other thing that strikes me about this is she is still, even as she's, you know, realizing the erotic possibilities in the seemingly mundane or everyday, she's kind of talking to herself about them, or at least through you know, the way you narrate her. You know, she's kind of introspective about what she's getting out of this, you know, affinity for pornography.
Yeah, because I think it's those moments when we do things that seem to violate our sense of self or the values that we think that we possess, that our identity gets put under pressure. And so, you know, for instance, she kind of makes a move on one of her employees, and it's very awkward, and it goes badly, and she's full of remorse and full of the introspection is, why would I do this thing that I know is wrong? And she's sort of looking at, like, oh, is it just because I'm lonely, or am I sensing that there's an erotic connection between us? You know, what is going on? Why would I do something that I don't approve of? And I think for most of us, because we grow up in a culture where pornography in particular is not considered an especially healthy pastime, you know, there may be always, a side order of guilt with that.
Well, at the same time, it seems like Brendan is having these conversations with himself, but in a way, it sounds like his question is, why do all these other people think that what I'm doing is wrong?
Yeah, he's, for Brendan is so out of touch with his emotions, but he does feel like he's being judged, and that he's not measuring up, and he's and he also feels lonely. You know, he's cut off from the sort of male friendships that have been the focus of his life, because he's got a roommate he's close to, but the roommate sort of disappears on him, and he's left probably for the first time in his life on his own. And what he discovers is that he's sad, you know, depressed, and his self-esteem is low, and he has these episodes where he wants to cry, and he has no idea why he's doing that. And you know, his mystification at what's happening to him is very different from his mother's attempts to kind of analyze her motives and her behavior.
Is there any significance to the title's reference to Eve as Mrs. Fletcher? She is divorced and might otherwise be referred to as Ms. Fletcher, or just Eve. Why was the Mrs. important in the title?
You know, it's funny. So this was not the title that I started with. I wanted to call the book The MILF, just because once Eve starts to think of herself in that way, it's almost like an identity. She takes on like a superhero identity. but in the first chapter, she runs into her son's girlfriend who she doesn't like, and the girl keeps calling her Mrs. Fletcher, and he says, please don't call me that. And you get the sense that she feels saddled by this idea of herself as a married woman, a divorced woman. She's held on to her ex-husband's name for professional reasons. And when my publisher said, you know, we'd prefer not to use the title you would like, we started to go through the book and looked for other titles, and we saw Mrs. Fletcher, and my first feeling was, that's not a great title because Eve doesn't want to be Mrs. Fletcher. But then I thought, oh, it's actually the flip side of the MILF, meaning she's not happy with the identity she starts with, so she takes on this new identity. So it's just using the identity she's unhappy with at the beginning and using that as a starting point rather than jumping right ahead to the new identity that she tries on in an attempt to shake up her life.
Was it hard to leave your preferred title behind?
It was, because, you know, I just wrote the whole book telling myself that I had the title. And so we didn't decide on Mrs. Fletcher until very late in the process. I'm happy with it now because I think it doesn't tip off the reader, and it's not so in your face as the other title that I had. It also has a nice Mrs. Robinson vibe, which
right,
I think
right.
Is a serious reference point for this book.
Was there any one character in this book that was hardest for you to figure out?
Well, you know, I decided to write a transgender woman character, East Professor Margot Fairchild, and you know, I had to do a lot of reading and talking to people and listening to feel like I had the kind of understanding of who Margot was that would allow me to write about her. And so it wasn't so much that she was difficult to write. It was more that I felt like a real responsibility, because that experience wasn't my own, and I didn't want to get it wrong or write about it in a way that seemed sensational or superficial. So I have to leave it up to the reader to know whether I accomplished that, but it was definitely something that I approached with a certain amount of anxiety and a sense of responsibility.
Well, and we see her through Margot through Eve's eyes, so she is kind of trying to figure it out, you know, along with us, along with you.
Exactly. And you know, the book is really about that moment when what had been a kind of arcane academic discussion of gender, it kind of burst onto the into the mainstream culture. And I did feel like it was really interesting to watch people who had never encountered these ideas encounter them and wrestle with them and try to behave in decent ways, but still to have doubts and to understand how strange it could seem if you simply had grown up in a world where there were men and there were women, and that those things were biologically determined rather than culturally determined. And it is a challenging set of ideas, and a lot of people are grappling with them now, and I wanted to kind of get into the heads of people who are doing that.
Well, given how many challenging ideas are in this book, it seems like you've really accomplished something in the sense that, I mean, I think I certainly came out of it feeling pretty good about things.
Oh, good. Well, I think the book is comic in the very traditional literary sense, which says there's chaos, but we can reach a new sense of order, that there's a place for everyone in a world that makes sense.
Well, I think I'll leave it at that. Tom Barada, it's a great book. Thanks so much.
Oh, thanks so much, Mitch. I really appreciate it.
Tom Barada is the author of 9 works of fiction, including The Leftovers, The Abstinence Teacher, and his latest, Mrs. Fletcher. We reached him at his home in Massachusetts.
One last break, and then we'll meet 2 of the people behind All In Productions' staging of Next to Normal, which opens later this week. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. The musical Next to Normal opens this Thursday at Next Act Theater in the Third Ward. It tells the story of a superficially average American family. Dad, mom, daughter, and son. But in the midst of their seemingly easygoing lives lies a hidden truth, the mom's challenges with bipolar disorder.
It's being staged by a relatively new company on the Milwaukee theater scene, one whose story is itself pretty interesting. Lake Effect's Bonnie North spoke with Alex Sherrell, one of the founders of All In Productions, along with Tim Backus, who directs Next to Normal, and they offered some background on the company.
So All In Productions was kind of a dream of myself and then also Robbie McGee, who is the other co-founder of the company. We had been talking, I think like a lot of artists really do, about kind of starting our own company way back since we lived together. And I want to say it was 2010, 2011, kind of we started talking about that after we first met. And then, you know, you time jump a couple years ahead, we got into a situation where we could actually put some money into starting this company. And we really just kind of wanted to do, you know, there's a lot of great companies in Milwaukee, but, you know, there aren't always as many opportunities for local actors as there could be. So we really were looking for a company that could do that. And once we got the opportunity to put that goal forward, we just kind of went for it.
So how long have you been an official company?
We have been, this is our third season, so since 2014.
Yeah, debut show was December 2014. Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And you jumped in, Tim, pretty much close on at the beginning?
Yeah, so I was involved in our debut production the last 5 years as the understudy to Jamie. And after that, about a year later, I was invited to become a part of the All In Productions board when one of the board members moved south to Florida. So I've been with the company in a board and an advisory role ever since then. So
was the idea, I know there have been a lot of little companies around trying to, you know, offer things, particularly for young actors. I mean, we've talked about that with other people on this show about how there's a lot of great theater for established actors, but getting your chops, you know, sort of getting on stage and having a chance to work on roles can be an issue. And there's been Young Blood and there's been other smaller companies. What exactly were you hoping to do with this? Was it just a chance to get some directing chops, get some acting chops with the idea of moving out, or are you trying to grow the company into something bigger?
I think it initially started off as being a place where we could give like talented people who we knew that weren't getting those kind of opportunities a place where they could display their talents and strengths. But as we've kind of gone on over the last few years, I think that we've seen, especially as we've been getting some great press, like we have this opportunity to really create something great in the Milwaukee theater space. And our goal has really become to create an environment in this city for artists to take on roles that they wouldn't have and to add to what's really becoming a growing, blossoming arts scene here in Milwaukee. So, yeah, it initially started off as sort of a smaller kind of idea, but I think we're heading towards something bigger.
We're also, you know, we use a lot of younger artists, but we're definitely working with a lot of veterans in the city, too. We have the honor of working with a number of different individuals between for the past 3 years, past three seasons. So it's just a great chance to kind of build the company to kind of see where, you know, where we started and then where we want to go in terms of kind of making our mark on the theater scene in Milwaukee. I think everyone that's in the company is really in it for the long haul. So, I mean, it's not just going to be kind of a situation where we're just around for a few years and then we just disappear. We really want to be here for the long term.
So how do you see yourself differentiating from the other smaller companies in town? I mean, there are a lot of people who are doing a lot of great work. So what makes you guys stand out?
One big thing is that we do some musical theater in addition to straight plays, which a lot of the smaller companies either just don't have the ability to do or that's just not their area of focus. And so a lot of times the musical theater is either left to the community theaters, you know, out in the suburbs or to like the big players like Skylight or The Rep, where younger actors without those kind of resumes can't necessarily get into right away.
They might be in the chorus.
Yeah. So that's a big thing for sure. Also, I think just our mission in that we're trying to be as truly local as possible and, you know, at least paying a small amount that we can afford, you know, right now to everyone who works with us. I think those are two big things for sure.
Do you have like equity special contracts or anything, or are you just doing all non-union at this point?
All non-union at this point. We want to get to that point, but obviously right now we're just kind of one step at a time. So
right, yeah. You have to have a certain amount, you know, you have to be able to afford that,
right? Yeah.
You know, to do that. But yeah, that
it's always
that,
a struggle. Struggle in the theater world.
It always is. There's never enough money, and there's never enough time. Usually is how it works. And a lot of people who want to do it, which is both a good thing and sometimes not. But so for you, the two of you, you. Tim, you were acting and now you're directing this next production. Alex, are you acting and directing as well, or are you doing more of the administrative stuff?
I primarily do more of the administrative stuff. The past few shows I have, especially the ones that we've done in the Next Act performance space, I've been the stage manager for our productions, but we've been fortunate enough to be able to bring on an amazing stage manager, Kathy Stotz, for this show. So I've been able to kind of step back, and I also just got married, so that kind of also took up a lot of my time.
It's like you had a personal life.
How
selfish of you.
Yeah, I know.
Right? But I've been fortunate enough to just kind of been able to now scale back my involvement with the shows and work more on kind of the day-to-day operations of the company.
So looking at it in terms of financial backing, are you looking at grants? Are you looking how is that part of it working?
We look at grants. We've done some grant writing, and we're still obviously trying to get better at that. That's, I'm sure, as anyone who's been involved with a nonprofit knows, you know, it's something that you're always trying to perfect, always trying to get better at. And this is really our first year of going at it. We've done some fundraising this year through a fundraiser show we did called Against Type. And we also had a GoFundMe that we ran. So that's kind of our primary area of fundraising. And then, of course, we have ticket sales, but we're, I would say, pretty affordable, probably lower than what might be optimal for, you know, what we do. But, you know, we really want to make this affordable and accessible to everyone in the Milwaukee community. So,
right. And, you know, most theater companies, nobody's making their money on ticket sales. You know, making a little bit, but you're not going to balance your budget on ticket sales.
Right, for sure.
Yeah, having been someone who wasn't involved from an administrative perspective with theater companies before this, it was really shocking to me to, like, look at the numbers and be like, wow, these companies really have to work as hard as they can to make ends meet, to be able to turn profits on shows, and just to be able to meet all of their financial requirements. So, Yeah, it's been interesting.
Yeah, even with a nonprofit status where the idea is that everything gets plowed back in, you still have to balance your budget.
Yeah, right.
And it's tough to do. It's tough to do, particularly if you're depending on ticket sales, which most places will tell you don't.
Yeah, right.
Just yep. That's nice, but don't. Yeah. And so for your shows, how many do you have a season?
We've been trying to do about three. So for this year and next year, our goals are kind of to do two straight plays and a musical.
Okay. And are you primarily renting Next Act space when you do, or are you traveling around the city?
Around. So we, for Next to Normal, obviously we're at Next Act Theater, and we've used that space for a couple of our other musicals, but we had a smaller play this spring called Circle Mirror Transformation that we had at the Alchemist Theater in Bayview. We've also worked, we did a show at the Villa Terrace, and we've done a show at In Tandem Theater, which is the 10th Street Theater over by Marquette. So
it's nice to be able to kind of take your shows to different communities, too.
Yeah, and we can sort of match the show that we're doing to the space that we want to perform it in, so we have sort of the ideal setting for each show that we put on.
Well, and you're also not responsible for the maintenance and upkeep of...
Yeah, to an extent, yeah.
I mean, you don't own the building kind of thing, so that helps, you know. It helps you be a little more nimble, I would think.
Yeah, it's interesting being nomadic. There are definitely benefits, of course, to having your own space, but obviously for a new company, it's something that's almost impossible. So, you know, it's been great to wander around the different theaters that are in the downtown and the east side and in the Bayview. And it's just been everyone we've worked with, all the facilities, venues we've worked with have been just so receptive and so great. I can't say enough about, you know, how helpful they've all been as we've kind of learned our way through this process.
That's what I really appreciate the most, I think, about this community in Milwaukee is that everybody's like in it together. You can see that like on a citywide level, not just in the arts, but everybody's really invested in creating something great in this city right now. And the arts are a microcosm of that. There's all these theater companies that are growing and new ones popping up, and everybody's just really supportive of each other, which is fantastic. You don't have that in a lot of other cities.
Right. And you've got places like Next Act and In Tandem that offer their space when they're not in production themselves, and that's just really wonderful to get into a bigger space for you guys. And Alchemist is a wonderful space to see a show in.
Yeah.
You know, it's not, you don't get a lot of audience. It's not very big. What it's like, you know, 60 people.
60, 70.
Yeah, something like that. Mm-hmm. But it's a terrific space.
Yeah. And Aaron Kopek there is fantastic. And they've got an awesome little bar space, you know, outside there. So, yeah.
Well, Next to Normal, it is a great musical. Interesting choice, particularly for a smaller company to do, because it's got somewhat big production values, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
So why this show now?
Well, when we were talking about our season theme for this year, we settled on the theme of Let's Talk. And basically the general idea, we were talking about this at the end of last year after the election and everything. And we can all agree that we're living in a pretty divisive time right now in our country. And rather than finding shows that like try too hard to be edgy or make like divisive statements, we wanted to find shows that created positive, constructive discussions for people to come together and appreciate. And so with Next to Normal, the issue of mental health, specifically bipolar disorder for this show, I think pretty much everyone can agree that this is something that deserves more attention and focus. We don't really know a lot about mental health and mental disease still, and as such, there's a lot of stigma that goes along with it, and this show tackles that really well and creates the potential for a lot of really outstanding constructive discussions.
Well, and with some great songs.
Oh, yeah. The music is incredible.
The music is amazing. I mean, it truly is. You think, you know, I've seen it a couple of times in different places, and you think, oh, I'm going to, the first time I remember thinking, this is an interesting topic for a musical, and I was completely absorbed.
Yeah, right. I was telling someone the other day, the first time I saw it, I didn't know anything about it, so I went into it thinking it was going to be like a sitcom. I came out, I was just like, wow, that was not what I expected. So emotionally powerful. Yeah.
Yeah. So the space, it's in Next Act, if I'm remembering, it's three-quarter, right? You're kind of in a little bit of a thrust.
Right.
So how are you keeping it simple in terms of the staging? Or
yeah, well, the whole vision of the show is that If you've seen like recordings of the Broadway production or even like other productions that have been done around here, a lot of times they have like a real sort of like rock stage kind of vibe to them. We're scaling that down, and the whole idea of the vision of this show is that we want to make it more intimate, more genuine. And the next act space really helps with that because the actors are surrounded on three different sides. And so being so close up to the actors and then having a set that we're designing more as like an actual like middle class home versus a rock stage with metal beams and poles and whatever. All of that, I think, goes toward really advancing and enhancing the experience that you get out of this show.
And so once this comes down, I know you're busy getting ready to put this up, but what are the other two shows for the season?
We opened with Circle Mirror Transformation, which was a fantastic play. And that was when we did Alchemist. That was earlier in the spring. And we actually run in a different kind of a season than the rest of the theaters and the community, just kind of the way I think, just because of the way we started. So we actually go by calendar year right now. So our third show is going to be a play. We actually are in kind of a to-be-announced stage. As much as I like to say what it is, we kind of have a few different things going on right now. So it's a little bit in limbo, but we will be announcing that, I think, within the next month or month and a half.
So people should just watch your Facebook and social media and website and all that stuff for the,
yeah,
for the announcement.
We're hoping to be able to announce potentially at Next to Normal as well. So
okay.
we'll see what happens.
Well, gentlemen, best of luck with this, your second show of this season. I look forward to talking to you as things go on. And maybe the next time I can go to a rehearsal and we can talk to folks.
Absolutely.
And be great.
Get some sound there. But in the meantime, break a leg with this one, and thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much.
Alex Sherrell is one of the founders of All In Productions. Tim Backus is communications director and directs All In's production of the musical Next to Normal, which runs this Thursday through Sunday and next Thursday through Sunday at Next Act Theater in Walker's Point. They spoke with Lake Effect's Bonnie North, and you can find more information at WUWN.com. That's all for the Tuesday edition of the show. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and I sure hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from listener-supported 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
It's 11 o'clock, so stay tuned. Fresh air is next.
I am the one who's helped you, and if you think that I just don't give a damn, you just don't know who